From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. What's on your summer reading list?
Books are great. Let's sit down with a book today. Books are fun. Books are great. Is it book time yet? Oh, I just can't wait to read a book.
The Bitter Southerner magazine proposes its summer reading picks. We'll hear about those soon. And also in a moment, we'll talk about people who argue for a living. By that, I mean lawyers. Some Georgia rural communities have no legal counsel in their area. Online services are popping up as an alternative, but is that a good option? Before we get to that, let's revisit a conversation we had about nerd culture in Georgia. Our state is home to conventions like MomoCon, which starts this week in Atlanta. There are also plenty of meetups and entertainment options that cater to the nerdy and proud, like many of our listeners. Here are your first thoughts.
Good morning. This is Dan B. Roth out of Roswell, Georgia. Not New Mexico. Roswell, Georgia. We have no UFOs. I am a combo of geek and nerd. I have a degree in engineering and all, and I'm a regular volunteer at Dragon Time. I'm a big-time science fiction nerd, and I grew up loving it ever since I was a little boy, starting out with Lost in Space and Star Trek, and then evolving into the other shows like $6 Million Man. And my favorite movies are, of course, all the Star Wars movies, Blade Runner, Soylent Green, and even worked in a movie theater just so I could watch the sci-fi movies that came out at that time for free and get memorabilia. So there you have it. Thank you for listening. Bye now.
Thanks, Dan. Nam D tweets, I consider myself a nerd because I have an affinity, love, and zeal for what I do and love, video games, anime, and web technology. Also, someone named Operation Anime Storm used Facebook to remind us, with Memorial Day around the corner, that we should not forget the military geeks of the world. Operation Anime Storm writes, quote, there are thousands of nerd geeks in uniform at any time, and we are some of the most obsessive of all nerd geeks. I've met guys who've come home on leave and act as directors at conventions and SEA Society for Creative Anachronism tournaments in Afghanistan, not to mention the contributions we have made to this country in science, tech, and society. End quote. Thank you, Operation Anime Storm, right you are. Listeners, we want to hear from you. What do you like to nerd about? What do you like to nerd all over? Give us a call, 404-500-9457. That's 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OST Talk, or you can post to our Facebook page, and we might feature your comments on the show. Some Georgia law schools are wanting to appeal to more than just their traditional law students. In the fall, the University of Georgia begins offering a graduate degree program for non-lawyers interested in understanding more about the law. Graduates of this master's program won't be eligible to take the bar exam or to practice law, but they will certainly be smarter for it. As schools try to broaden the appeal of legal education, even if it's legal education that doesn't necessarily lead to being a lawyer, there remains a major concern about Georgia's lawyer shortage. A few years ago, the websites Indeed and Sparefoot.com ranked Atlanta as the nation's best city for lawyers based on salary, available jobs, and cost of living. Not surprisingly, Atlanta has a lot of lawyers. Most major metro areas do, but many rural areas do not. The State Bar of Georgia says there are communities in the state where there simply are zero lawyers, not one. Former Georgia Supreme Court Justice Hugh Thompson noted this in a State of the Judiciary address. He says because of the lack of legal representation, more people choose to represent themselves in civil matters.
Judges worry not only about clogged dockets as a result of these pro se litigants, but more importantly, about unfair trials and unjust results. Our legal system is an adversarial system of justice. The reality is that poor people who represent themselves often lose.
Now, we've seen a number of companies form lately that offer online legal services, but are these viable alternatives? I talked about this in 2015 with Mark Britton, who founded one such company, Avo Inc. It's an online company designed to connect lawyers with the people who need them, in person or not. We were also joined by Patrice Perkins Hooker, former president of the State Bar of Georgia, and I began by asking Patrice what it means when some counties have no lawyers.
That actually means that there are no lawyers who reside or practice in the county. And although there are now five counties that is a fact, we also have 18 counties that only have one lawyer in them.
Okay. So what does that mean practically for a person's ability to secure representation? I mean, surely in criminal cases, people still have a constitutional right to counsel. The government's going to pay for a public defender to drive over the county line or something, right?
That's correct. It's generally the people who are poor and mildly educated or uneducated, I should say, who live in the county, migrant workers, folks who are unable to access a computer, access a car, and other means of transportation to get to another county, that are really the ones who are suffering the most from the lack of readily available legal services.
And specifically with civil cases, lawsuits, right, where you don't have a guaranteed right to counsel.
That's correct.
Okay. So, Mark Britton, you're the CEO of a company that connects people to legal services via the internet. Tell us about your service and whether or not you think it can help people in situations like these.
Sure, and not can help, does. I mean, in Georgia alone, AVO, which, by the way, it's AVVO, Alpha Victor Victor Oscar .com. So we help every month, on a yearly basis, about 13% of the Georgia adult population. And we have 8,000 lawyers that participate, so that's roughly 37% of the lawyer population. And so our whole mission is to put consumers and lawyers together, but really in a way that makes legal services routinely accessible to everyone.
So yeah, but does that mean just finding a lawyer through a website, or does that mean the lawyer actually helping me through the internet rather than meeting me face-to-face?
Yeah, it's both, really, because some people, what's amazing about people when they start on their legal journey is a lot of people don't even understand that they have a legal issue. They know that it might involve a lawyer, but they get on the internet, and they've been taught by the internet and other companies that they can do it themselves, right?
Right.
So, as in, the Supreme Court justice talking about pro se or do-it-yourself litigants, there is this, it's almost a bit of a crisis, because you have all these consumers who sort of believe they need a lawyer or to resolve a legal issue, but they have no idea where to start. So we give them the tools. We have a Q&A, for example, where you can come in for free and ask a question, and real lawyers respond. Or you can, for $39, you can push a button and have a lawyer call you back in 15 minutes to where you can have an orientation session regarding your legal issue. So it's just, it's making those legal services very mobile, on demand, and accessible.
We talked to a New Hampshire attorney named Donald Sinkovich, who also provides online legal consultations via a competing service of yours. And he says that because of the lack of lawyers in some communities, people will just take legal matters into their own hands, and then bad things happen. Here's what he said.
People do go into court and litigate on their own behalf, but that's kind of like me fixing my car. I'm a smart guy. I can get a manual, watch some YouTube videos, but I don't know what I don't know. And if I make mistakes with, a child custody matter anything really, frankly, property matters, I can really cause myself some harm.
I think that makes a lot of sense, but Patrice Perkins Hooker, former president of the State Bar of Georgia, are you convinced that effective legal representation can be obtained over the internet?
I am not. I have seen numerous horror stories where people who are provided with 15 minutes or 30 minutes of time just don't have enough time to know what questions to ask, and just don't know what to do once they've gotten that advice. And that is generally very clear in cases involving domestic relations where there's divorce, custody, child support issues, especially in the domestic violence area. You need to be able to sit there and talk to somebody, counsel that person, and walk with them, walk literally with them through the court process.
Mark, how would you respond to that?
Well, it's a bit short-sighted, to be totally frank, because if you look at the numbers in the United States, you have 50% of medium to high-income consumers who are avoiding the legal profession. If you go into lower income, it's about 84%. And then on the other side, you have massive attrition rates for lawyers who are leaving the legal profession. And so you have the needy consumers on one side, and you have the needy lawyers on the other. And whereas you take a service like Avvo, and what we're doing is actually making it easier for the consumer and the lawyer to start the conversation, because it's not a question of whether it's good to have a longer or shorter conversation with a lawyer. Absolutely, it's better to have a longer conversation. But if you never even begin the conversation with a lawyer or the legal profession and go down the do-it-yourself path, well, then what have we accomplished at all? Lawyers do amazing things for our community. And so let's figure out the ways that we can get lawyers in front of those needy consumers.
I realize I'm setting up an adversarial dynamic between the two of you, but you're lawyers. You're familiar with that. Patrice, I want to ask you about legislation that you're pursuing, but do you want to respond to Mark quickly?
No, that's Mark. I'll let Mark's opinion stand.
Okay. All right. Okay. I'll ask, though, do you see a role for attorneys, whether it's through a private service like Avvo or through perhaps some state-facilitated service to provide some amount of consultation via remote methods to people who are in remote places?
I think that is a good community service project, volunteer project to provide manned help centers and help desks. But my objective is really to try to deal with the bigger problem is if you don't have a lawyer in the system, it's more than just in your community, it's more than just you having access to civil matters. It's also the way in which the government or the police or other people react to you because they know you don't have access to anybody who can come get them or hold them accountable locally.
Mark Britton, we've got about 40 seconds left. I'll give you the last word.
If you look at, for most people, whether it's in rural Georgia or Atlanta or beyond, they all have a phone in their hand, mobile phones. It is becoming a primary way that we stay connected in our world. And the cost of those, the accessibility, they're ubiquitous. And so mobile phone is the internet. And the ability for people to access a competent lawyer in real time through that mobile phone, it's coming, and it has to be a part of the legal services that we provide, and it is the service that Avvo provides.
That's Mark Britton. He's founder of the company Avvo, Inc. It's designed to connect lawyers with the people who need them, in person or not. I also spoke with Patrice Perkins Hooker, former president of the State Bar of Georgia. This is On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Need something to do this summer? How about enjoying a good book? The Bitter Southerner magazine is here with its recommendations of 2018's best Southern books. On Second Thoughts, Virginia Prescott spoke with Chuck Reese and Kyle Jones of The Bitter Southerner.
Well, Kyle, let's start off with the book Visible Empire. This book was kind of sort of set in Atlanta.
It was. It kicks off in 1962. The Orly plane crash has just happened, and all these wealthy Atlanta patrons perish in a plane crash. And this, you know, obviously this actually happened. And all the characters in the book are left with to move through their grief. And it's everything. It's people have lost husbands and wives and brothers and parents and mistresses. And so two of the main characters, she is pregnant and her husband is in Atlanta, and his mistress has passed away. She worked for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. The interesting thing about this book is that it is all the things we know and love. If you live in Atlanta, you know all these characters, or you know the places, you know the paper, you know the High Museum. I mean, it's interesting, and it makes you want to know more about that historical event.
Because these were art patrons, right? Mm-hmm. This was a very elite segment of mm-hmm. Atlanta culture. So how much of it is historical fiction and how much of it is real? Because there are survivors or families who lost people in that crash.
Right. I would call it historical fiction. It is a book that is based on that event. And when you read it, you're really trying to figure out who's who. But Ivan Allen, the mayor at the time, he has every other chapter where he argues with his wife. It's light. It's beach reading.
It's beach reading about an air tragedy.
I know. It doesn't sound right, but that's what it is.
So, Chuck, you chose something a little bit deeper. This is called The Fighter, and the author is Michael Ferris Smith?
Yeah, Michael Ferris Smith is a Mississippi writer, and I think he's maybe one of just the most skilled when it comes to good old-fashioned slinging of words and making beautiful sentences. He's probably one of the most skilled young writers working in the South.
What's the book about?
The book is about a young man whose name is Jack Boucher. And we meet Jack when he is 2 years old and dropped off with only a diaper and a bag at a Salvation Army and in Tunica, Mississippi. And he goes on to earn his living as a fighter in backwoods cage matches.
Oof.
But the book is about the end of his career and his attempt to, before he gets out of the game, just to earn enough money to get the woman who adopted him and took him in and raised him back into her house and out of a nursing home because she's suffering from dementia and she's dying.
Oh, sounds like a pretty intense book.
It's a very intense book. But the thing about the way Michael writes these things is that he weaves the stories together so beautifully, speaks to, you know, the issues that plague rural communities. And he does it in a way that just keeps you popping right through.
Hmm.
It's paced very much. It's like a fast-paced detective thriller, but it's not a detective thriller.
And you chose another book, Country Dark, that kind of picks up on those themes of problems plaguing rural populations.
There's a lot of good fiction that's set in Appalachia these days. And Chris Offutt was arguably one of the people who, you know, folks these days, you hear them talk about Appalachian noir as a genre.
Mm-hmm.
And arguably, Offutt was one of the early pioneers of that. He came out with a book of short stories back in 1992 called Kentucky Straight that just blew everybody away, won a bunch of prizes for it. But Country Dark is actually the first fiction he's published in 21 years. He's written a couple of memoirs. He's been writing for TV shows, Weeds on Showtime, and he wrote the two best episodes of True Blood, in my opinion, on HBO. But Country Dark is set, it moves from the mid-50s to the early 70s, and it's centered around a young veteran coming home from the Korean War and who winds up making a living in the moonshining business, thus gets put in jail, which makes it very hard for the young wife he married to raise the five kids that they have. And how they get through that is great. And one thing I love about this book, too, is that Chris did something at the end of it that no author ever does anymore. The epilogue was written like one paragraph on every single major character in the book.
Oh, yeah, and like they've done in some films, right?
I love that. Me too.
And, yeah, and I was like, it was just so satisfying to read that, you know, because you'd really gotten into the lives of all these people and, you know, the story reaches its climax, but you know their lives go on, and to have a little hint at what happens is a lot of fun. I could talk forever about how happy I am at the kind, at the quality of writing coming out of people who grew up in the mountains like I did.
Both Chuck and I are from the mountains.
So we got like a little
bit
of, yeah.
Well, there's another book here, a little less heavy, but also dealing with some weighty themes, The Hidden Light of Northern Fires. Darren Wong is the author. We had Darren Wong on Second Thought to talk about his book. Now, this is what he had to say about his main character, Mary Willis.
She went away to college at Alfred University in 1857. She's about 18 years old at the time. Well, women did not go to college in 1858. She went to Alfred University, which was only the second school in the country to take women. It was Alfred is about 30 miles from Seneca Falls, New York, which is the epicenter of feminism.
So this is about the main character from the book, Mary Willis, Darren Wong talking there. Who wants to pick this one up?
Well, I like to think of Mary Willis as the anti-Scarlett O'Hara. I really do.
Because, how so?
Well, this book is in its own way sort of Gone with the Wind told from the other side.
Well, the interesting thing is it's about a northern town that was a holdout. It was a Confederate town in what, New York? Upstate
New York? They seceded, yeah.
That was true.
And that is true. And that's actually the town where Darren Wong grew up. But he's been living in the South for a long time now. And the fact that he wrote this book that is about, whose main character is a young woman during the Civil War trying to keep her family farm operating. But unlike Scarlett O'Hara, I would argue that she has better intentions, because what she does is uses her barn as a place for escaped slaves to hide out before they can cross the river into Canada and freedom.
Kyle Jones and Chuck Reese are with me from The Bitter Southerner. We're getting their summer reading list. So let's get a little bit of a palate cleanser, can I say that, about Soul?
Some sherbet. okay, Soul, this book. Well, first of all, it's by Chef Todd Richards, who is a friend of The Bitter Southerner, and we love his food and have followed his career. But this book is gorgeous. It's called Soul, and it's Chef Todd Richards calls himself a preacher about food. And this this book is divided into ingredients. And what he does is he takes the food of his ancestors and of his family, and he pushes the genre. And so if you've ever eaten at Richard Southern Fried in Crog Street Market in Atlanta, he serves collard green faux. Or pho, however you say it.
Pho.
Pho. And in this book, we've got collard green ramen. I mean, he talks about Soul and the mashup of cultures that have created Soul and pushed it forward. Anyway, it's just beautiful. The photography is beautiful. The recipes are amazing. And it's soul food next level.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of a challenging book, but what I like about it is that unlike most cookbooks, it really does reflect like the changing culture of this place in a way that you rarely see anybody write a cookbook to do.
One thing I love that he calls them the supposed tos.
What?
You know, like you're supposed to do such and such with collards or with peaches or whatever, and he's like, forget the supposed tos. That's like my new favorite term.
I like that for a cookbook. Uh-huh. So wait, you said challenging book. In what way?
Well, I just think that, you know, it's challenging that in that it's a reflection of his own experience. You know, people who grow up in the South on these sort of older, time-honored food traditions, when they move into the cities, you know, all these other cultural influences come in and they enrich Southern cuisine. But we tend to write most of our cookbooks about how to make a cathead biscuit. Nothing wrong with a cathead biscuit, but you see what I mean.
This is a deep cookbook, I think, is what Chuck is getting at. Like, he talks about that the more we understand each other's cultures and the more we bring all those people to the table, we understand each other through food. And it's something the Bitter Southerners talked about since our first days.
Food and music, they're really good ways for people to talk to each other about difficult stuff.
Let's hear just a little bit from Todd Richards talking about the book on the podcast Folklore.
There's a French name on it, and we could charge X amount of dollars. And then if I did it, you know, just as an African-American chef, I can only charge X amount of dollars for it. So I was saying in the book that we have to move that equality and make sure that soul food is a recognized cuisine.
So this is the first time you all have included cookbooks on your Bitter Southerner reading list, right?
There was one before a couple of years ago. We did a cookbook about the history of Appalachian food called Victuals or Vittles. And that was an amazing book, but that's the only time we've ever done that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, until now.
What else have you got this time?
What else do we have this time? Oh, my God.
I'm seeing The Cooking Gene, which looked like a really interesting book to me.
And Turnip Greens and Tortillas.
All right.
Yeah.
It just keeps getting better.
Yeah.
Turnip Greens and Tortillas, for anybody, you know, anywhere there's a Taqueria del Sol location, you will appreciate this book because it will teach you how to make that wonderful queso. But that's another cross-cultural cookbook about Eddie Hernandez coming in and you know, establishing a distinctly Southern take on the food of his youth in Mexico. As for The Cooking Gene, it's not really a cookbook. Each chapter ends with a little recipe, but it's a book about the nature of Southern food.
Well, I think Michael Twitty asked some really interesting questions, it seems to me, about like owns Southern cooking, which I think is something you at the Bitter Southerner have kind of taken on as a question.
Well, you know, he says in the book, the Old South is a place where people use food to tell themselves who they are, to tell others who they are, and to tell stories about where they've been. It is also a place in the mind where we dare not talk about which came first, the African cook or the European mistress, the Native American woman, or the white woodsman. Mm. And, you know, my takeaway from this book essentially is that the food of the South, you know, this idea of Southern food, which all of us revere so highly, is one of the most, if not the most, multicultural creation that the South has ever seen, and we actually did it in spite of ourselves.
Mm, that sounds a little like Don T. Edge's book, right?
The Potlicker Papers. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I you know, one of the things that people will see in our list is we do actually equate those two books. I think those two books, both of which came out last year, it's just that The Cooking Gene came out a good bit later and thus wasn't on our list last year. These are two books about food, but they're really two of the best histories of the American South that have come out in a while. And that's the way I look at them.
So, Kyle, you have a little bit more beach book, or let's say hammocky book kind of read about food. This is Emily Nunn's book, The Comfort Food Diaries.
Yeah, I love this book. To me, I mean, she writes like a house on fire. It is not the typical beach book. It's a meaningful memoir where Emily Nunn, who, by the way, Chuck, she was at Georgia when we were there.
I believe so.
I know. I didn't know that. And it was interesting. I was reading this book, and then I got to some chapters where I knew people. I'm like, oh, my goodness. This book meant so much to me. She goes through a terrible breakup, and she creates the comfort food tour where she goes and reacquaints herself with old friends and family and works on a drinking problem along the way. I mean, you laugh and you cry, and I can't recommend the Comfort Food Diaries enough. It's awesome.
You also included a children's book or some YA fiction
for the first time, yeah.
So what have you got there?
Okay, the cutest book by one of our favorite illustrators, Natalie Nelson, along with the writer Kyle Lukoff, have created a storytelling of ravens, and it's all set around how do you say it, Chuck?
Veneries.
Veneries are the words for groups of animals. So it's just, it's darling. But did you know that?
No.
Did you know about these words?
I know the words.
Yeah.
You know,
a flock
of seagulls.
Yes.
Not that we want to think of the band.
No,
right
we
now.
Don't. We don't want to discuss them.
But what is it for crows? Isn't it a fantastic word?
A murder of crows,
right.
A bloat of hippos.
Who knew?
A smack of jellyfish. I just like to say that. A smack of jellyfish.
A smack of jellyfish.
But it's beautiful. It's beautiful. And it's a children's book, but I'm putting it on my coffee table. I love it. It's so gorgeous.
Any more children's books?
We do have a couple of one YA novel on here. And
Amal Unbound.
Well, there's two. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Amal Unbound and Dear Martin by Nick Stone, which is a great piece of African-American young adult fiction that has really gotten a wide audience in the last year. And he's a good Southern writer.
That's Chuck Reese and Kyle Jones of The Bitter Southerner. They spoke with On Second Thoughts' Virginia Prescott about the best Southern books of the year, and you can find their complete list at bittersoutherner.com. It's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea. Is there something in the water in Athens, Georgia? A lot of musical talent is born there. R.E.M., the B-52s, Drive-By Truckers, Matthew Sweet. It's been more than 30 years since Matthew Sweet broke out on the Athens music scene, and his star rose throughout the 90s. Now he's out with his 13th album, Tomorrow's Daughter. I Belong to You from Matthew Sweet's latest album, Tomorrow's Daughter, released last week. On tomorrow's show, Matthew Sweet will give us more from the album, but we'd like to hear from you. Who is the most important artist to come out of Athens in your estimation? Give us a call, 404-500-9457, and be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m.
Before the break, we talked about the Bitter Southerner magazine's summer reading list that was released today. We couldn't get to every title on the list. Take Thomas Mullen's new novel, Lightning Men. That's on the list as well. Lightning Men is a follow-up to his earlier novel, Darktown. Both of these books tell the story of Atlanta's first black police officers. In the Jim Crow South, black and white neighborhoods were separated by law, of course, but some police departments added African-American officers to their squads to cover the black communities. Atlanta hired 8 black men in 1948 as police officers, but their authority was greatly restricted. Thomas Mullen talked about his newest book, Lightning Men, last year with my colleague, Celeste Headley.
Let's first talk about that title, because it refers to a specific thing. Who are the Lightning Men?
So Lightning Men refers to a group that existed in Atlanta. It was our very own homegrown fascist organization. They called themselves the Columbians. They dressed in Nazi brown shirts, complete with SS lightning bolt patches on their sleeve, designed after the Nazi stormtrooper lightning bolt. And they made it a point of showing up in neighborhoods where African-Americans had bought a house in previously white-only neighborhoods, and showing up to intimidate them and start fights. They recruited other adherents at mills around town, and they finally got shut down in the late 40s when they went even further than that and advocated overthrowing the state government.
And what was interesting to me was that I would have assumed they would have been in league with, or at least friendly with, the KKK, but your books suggest that was not the case.
Yeah, there are all sorts of different variations of white supremacy. And you had the Ku Klux Klan, obviously, and then you had the Columbians. The KKK kind of looked down on the Columbians as these goofy kid dropouts who were a little too enamored with Hitler. Remember, this is after World War II. This is after we fought a war to defeat fascism. And a few years later, here we have a Nazi-style group operating in Atlanta. So the Klan kind of looked down their noses at them. But then you also had neighborhood associations that looked down at the Klan, even though they really wanted the same thing, which was to keep blacks out of white neighborhoods.
But it makes for such a great foil in a fictional novel, because you're African Americans are sort of beset on all sides. There's just, it's really, friends are hard to come by. And even the one white detective who has been helping them and certainly helped them in the first book, he himself says, I'm not doing this ever again.
Yeah, I'm always interested in finding the different fault lines in different communities. And so for a book like this, obviously, there's a lot of conflict between African Americans and whites. But I'm also interested in looking into what divides the white community and what divides the black community. So within the white community, you did have some progressives who wanted, African Americans to be treated better. They, wanted anti-lynch legislation. They wanted to revoke the poll tax and things like that. They thought black schools should be better funded. But there were also, they also still couldn't imagine a world without segregation. They still thought that the races should be kept separate. So there's a lot of disagreement among whites about how to do things. And within the black community, there was a lot of disagreement as well about how far should they go, how hard should they push. And so, as a novelist, I like finding those tensions and finding ways to exploit them.
I mean, it makes it sound like we're talking about a history book. And really, this is a mystery / thriller at its heart. The problem for me is that it's really hard to talk about any plot points without spoiling, because you get a spoiler almost from the very beginning of the novel. The character of the first person who gets out of prison and is released is someone that I can't say who that is, because who he
is, that's true,
is important. But he says this one thing, and I want to read it. The character named Jeremiah, he's just out of prison, and the cops have set up a system whereby somebody's released from prison can be sent back almost immediately to prison. And he says, why do they act this way? I don't understand this world, not this world meaning the outside as opposed to prison, but this world meaning everything. Does that sentiment change at all by the end?
Maybe.
As a symbol, I guess.
Maybe not for him, but I mean, all the characters are trying to understand what's going on in this crazy world. And it was a time of great change. I mean, it was right before a lot of the seminal victories of the civil rights movement that we learn about in school. Like the Montgomery bus boycott is going to be in 55, and Brown versus Board of Education is going to be in 54, but this book is set in 50. So all of those currents and threads are still going on at that time, but nothing's happened yet. And within the black community at this time, there's also a sense of disappointment. People thought there were going to be a lot of changes with World War II, since we fought a war to defeat fascism, and African American newspapers thought that we should also be fighting to overthrow Jim Crow at the same time. They called it the Double V campaign, the Double V campaign for victory over fascism and victory over Jim Crow. But that hadn't quite happened yet. And so I think there's a lot of confusion going on all sides. The world had just gone through so much change with the Depression, with the war, and everybody was kind of wondering what's going to happen next.
There's a point in there where you're, as a novelist, are imagining how these sort of backroom deals had to be made. And it's one where they're sort of, they're negotiating where the lines of segregation will be drawn in a neighborhood. And it struck me because many people think of the Atlanta Way, capital Atlanta, capital Way, as something to be proud of. That's how Atlanta has escaped a lot of the racial turmoil that has beset other cities like Los Angeles or Detroit or New York. But in your book, the Atlanta Way kind of feels a little bit gross.
Interesting.
It feels a little bit like people simply not taking a stand or avoiding conflict in order to keep the peace when they really needed to have the conflict. And that was all coming out of your imagination? Or really my question is, how much did you find out about how these deals were made or not?
I tried to make that as based on fact as possible. So I am a novelist. This is fiction. And so I'm going to exploit things for tension and suspense as much as I can. But I want the surrounding world and the politics to be as dead on accurate as possible. And you'll create my little fictional events within that structure. And yeah, the Atlanta Way, it can look that way. It can look a little backward looking back through time, especially, you know, after the mid-60s when you had this generational change within the civil rights leadership and, you know, a younger generation that came of age in about 60, 61, 62, saying, like, we're tired of the way that our fathers are going about it, this incrementalism, this asking for crumbs off the white man's table. We need to push harder. And, you know, obviously it's easy to agree with that now. In 1950, it was more complicated because, you know, Atlanta was only 40 some odd years removed from a race riot where whites rioted and attacked blacks and drove them out of downtown. So for black community leaders at that time, you know, they were working hard to win concessions from the white majority, concessions like black officers hired in 1948, concessions like allowing certain neighborhoods that had previously been all white, you know, opening those up African Americans. And that's a scene in the book that you're referring to where some black community leaders sit down with white community leaders and try to negotiate, okay, well, where can black families move into safely? And looking back on it now, and one of the characters in the book, a young police officer, he's angered by this. He's like, well, we're bartering away where we can live. This is America. We should be able to live wherever we want. That's the perspective of Officer Lucius Boggs, who's kind of sickened by these negotiations that he observes. But his father, Reverend Boggs, who I see as a contemporary of Martin Luther King Sr., you know, the older wave of leadership at that time, you know, he feels like we're doing what we can to avoid another race riot. We're doing what we can to make things better for our people while avoiding violence. And, you know, I've worked hard to get this far. I don't want to hear you criticizing me. And that was a generational conflict that, you know, we would see more of in the years ahead.
So I want to read, I alluded earlier to the white detective who decides he's putting his family in danger by helping African Americans. He doesn't want to do this anymore. And his family situation gets very complicated in this book in a really interesting way. But it says, if any Negro officer ever asked another favor of him, he would decline. He wouldn't spit in their faces, no, but neither would he take a single risk for their cause ever again. He had his own battles to fight, and he couldn't afford to weaken himself by associating with the troubles that shadowed their every step. How much did you try to imagine yourself in the same position? To what extent did you think to yourself, well, what would I have done?
Well, first I should mention that passage you read is very late in the book. So a lot has gone on to get him to that point. And when I wrote this book and when I wrote the previous book, Darktown, you know, I was aware of the fact that in a lot of other books about race written by white people or films about race, starring a lot of white Hollywood actors, there's this character that kind of gets created of the white savior, where even if it's a story about civil rights in which you would think African Americans should be starring, or at the very least playing a very pivotal role. Weirdly, through some alchemy, the story winds up being about, you know, saving the soul of the white people, or the white people finally stepping up and doing the right thing. And although that is important, I didn't want that to happen with my book. And so there is this character of Dennis Rakestraw. He goes by Rake. He's a white cop, And he wants to be better than a lot of the white cops around him. He's not a violent thug. He's not a racist. He was raised in a household where you didn't use racial epithets and things like that. So he wants to do better, and he wants to see the black cops succeed. But one of the reasons he wants to see them succeed is because if the black cops succeed and the city hires more of them, then the city will have enough black cops to patrol all the black neighborhoods. And
he
white cops like Rick will never have to go to a
black.
Yeah, exactly. Because even progressive-minded whites back then still had a hard time imagining a world without segregation. So he's being pushed in the previous book and in this book to try to do the right thing and kind of cross the color line to help. But it doesn't always go well for him, and it didn't always go well for some white people who did take those steps, and often they would end up going back when they'd realize how hard it was and the pressures that it put on their family, the pressures that it put on their business. They'd realize, you know, I don't want to deal with this anymore. This is somebody else's problem. I want to back away. And that's, he comes to that point by the end of the book because of some things that happen.
If you're joining us, I'm speaking with Thomas Mullen. He's author of the new novel, Lightning Man. It's a sequel to his other novel, Darktown. So there's another sense in this book of how small a town Atlanta is. So you get this sense of space, right? They're traveling, and in a lot of ways, they cover a lot of ground, both in this and the earlier novel. But in the other sense, it's a small town. And I wonder how you got there. I mean, it must have been through your research that you kind of kept thinking, look, it's these same characters showing up again and again and again, or at least that's how I imagined it.
Yeah, well, when you're writing a novel, you want certain little coincidences or certain plot lines overlap. But also, I think something that's been remarked upon a lot is that in the modern world, we lack a certain sense of community that our parents or grandparents had, that in neighborhoods, people looked out for each other or knew everybody. So it's not just, I'm not necessarily trying to say that Atlanta is a small town, but certain neighborhoods would feel small, and that, you know, if you were raised in the Sweet Armor community, you would know a lot of other people from there too, and you'd know their brothers and sisters and past girlfriends and things like that. And so through the course of the book, you wind up certain characters know each other better than maybe you'd realize before. And I thought that was interesting to play with.
Did you know the end of the book before you started writing?
Gosh, that's a good question. I don't know if I remember anymore. Usually I have a pretty good idea of where I'm going, but I don't know exactly how I'm going to get there. So there's a few scenes towards the end that I had to figure some things out, especially with a crime novel where you have various intersecting plot lines. You want to make sure they make sense. And sometimes I'll be writing a book and I'll think, okay, this character is going to have a deep, dark secret, and I don't know what it is yet. And as I'm writing, I'll eventually figure it out, or I'll be doing some research and I'll discover some interesting thing that happened. I was like, ooh, I'm going to borrow that. So I think I knew most of it, but some of it was stuff that I worked out as I went.
And is this part of a trilogy?
I'm not going to limit myself to three. I think it's kind of fun. When I had the idea for Darktown, which was set in 48 when the city first hired its 8 black cops, I was struck by the fact that it's right before the civil rights movement really takes off, and that so much is going to change in Atlanta, in the South, and in America over the next 20 years. And as I was writing Darktown, it was getting longer and longer, and I was coming up with more subplots and more characters, and I quickly realized, you know, this could easily become like an 800-page doorstop of a novel if I wasn't careful. And I didn't want that to happen because not many people want to read 800-page novels. So I held some things back. So there were things in Lightning Man that I had initially been writing to go into Darktown that I later decided to pull back and save for a later book. So I don't have a magic number in mind, but I think there's a lot of different stories worth telling. And I think it'd be interesting to see what happens to some of these officers. You know, in 55, when the Montgomery bus boycott's going on and Martin Luther King Jr., a native Atlantan, becomes a national figure. What happens in 1960 when King moves to Atlanta at the same time that this younger generation of civil rights activists, you know, takes over and there are more demonstrations in Atlanta than there had been before? You know, what happens in the mid-60s? Like, it's interesting to trace the evolution of Atlanta and the evolution of our country, and you marry that to crime stories sort of as a, like the spoonful of sugar that makes maybe a reader able to embrace what can otherwise be difficult, heavy material.
Have you heard from any cops after they read Darktown? Did you hear from actual officers?
I've spoken with a few officers. I'm not sure how many I've spoken with who'd read the book first.
Or admitted it.
Yeah. But I've spoken, I mean, a lot of people have been interested in it. And when I've given talks, some cops have come up to me afterwards, or people who were former officers, or whose dad or uncle or cousin or sister was a cop, and have shared different stories they've told, not just in Atlanta, but in other parts of the country, and how, you know, different police departments have been integrated better than others. And in some cities, it took a long time before white and black cops could work together well.
Did you get any good ideas from these stories that you heard from either cops or their family?
Yeah, some. I'm always filing away little ideas because since I want to write a number of these books, I've got a giant piece of paper at home, two giant pieces of paper with different post-it notes, color-coded subplot ideas or character ideas or historical event ideas that I'm kind of rearranging as I go. But it's been fun. It's been fun to have a project like this. And it's been fun for me, an excuse to learn more about Atlanta history and become more, bound to the area that I live in.
But the people at the library near you must know your face and name.
At this point, I think so. But there's a few different libraries I make a habit of going to, so I'm going to different parts of the city.
That's author Thomas Mullen speaking with On Second Thoughts' Celeste Headlee. Mullen's latest novel, Lightning Men, is out now. It is on the summer reading list out today from the Bitter Southerner magazine. And that's our show for today, but what's on your summer reading list? Let us know. Give us a call, 404-500-9457. Bonus points if it's a book about the South. You can also post to Twitter or Facebook. We're at OST Talk on Twitter. Our show is produced by Fenley Foxen, LaRaven Taylor, Leighton Rowell, and Summer Evans. Sean Powers is the senior producer. Don Smith edits the show, and the engineer is Tyler Morris. For today, that's On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusea. Have a good one.